Yeah, so this talk is going to cover some work that's still very largely preliminary towards a chapter that moves from this collection of videos on the FBI file vault to something more like this. But before we get to that, I thought I'd start with this quote from Felix Stalder. Repressive orders crumble when people start to lose their fear and act in large numbers despite being monitored, not because they found ways to evade it. Security, in this case, comes from social solidarity and collective action and not from technology. So this project is very much unfinished business. I checked that box on the call for participation that asked if it was a work in progress. It's very much that. So I'm mostly here with like problems. So I will be bringing all of the cul-de-sacs that I'm kind of stuck in and thoughts, some of which will be dead ends and experiments that may spiral into chaos. So this is a lot of research that's developing into a set of projects that I'm calling oversight machines, which are operative images and other forms of media that right now are kind of poor operative images that I'll try to defend. I wanted to thank the organizers for this has been amazing so far, to the extent that I had to rewrite a lot of this in response to what's come before. That's the test of a good event. I also wanted to acknowledge Daniel Grinberg, a colleague of mine, started working on the same material at about the same time. And he has an article that cites some of my work. I'm building on quite a bit of his and highly recommend that. Sometimes it can get weird when you and someone else are working on the same thing. This didn't get weird. So one more. This paper isn't directly about Freddie Gray or the people who protested his death in the Baltimore uprising, 2015. But it operates at a few layers of abstraction and probably 1,000 feet or so away from that. But these events are deeply inscribed into the media that I'm talking about. Media that's produced and distributed by my government, but without the consent of anyone represented. So I'd like to acknowledge the layers of injustice here, the institutional and structural racism produced in and by the Baltimore PD and FBI, whose aerial surveillance captures the 18 and a half hours of protests from a fleet of manned aircraft equipped with infrared sensors in late April and early May of 2015. Baltimore PD's notorious record of police brutality produces the need for protest and then is further enacted there against the protesters. So I'm not gonna be playing video of these events. This isn't like an extinguishable fire. I'm not concerned that seeing napalm burns will turn you away from the facts or against me. The surveillance footage is not particularly violent. It's actually maybe worse in that it's boring. At times it feels experimental. But I think it's ultimately irretrievable. It's not like body cam footage. It's not an uncomfortable closeness. It's an uncomfortable distance. So one of Daniel Grinberg's conclusions in his essay, Tracking Movements, Black Activism, Aerial Surveillance, and Transparency Optics, which was published in Media, Culture, and Society in November, is that this footage functions to reproduce a criminalizing and deeply racialized gaze. Drawing from Simone Brown's idea of black luminosity, he writes, by transforming heat into an electronic signal and then a thermal image, the cameras reduce the protesters to their basic corporeal forms and biological expressions. Through the restrictive optic of this lens, they are both unwillingly registering their precarious humanity and being dehumanized. He goes on to suggest that views from below may counterbalance these dehumanizing gazes. Margaret Worrison's One Document for Hope is an exemplary example of this. Looking up at circling helicopters from the street, mixing the sometimes jubilant and sometimes tense ground level experience with police scanner signal. This kind of surveillant gaze is deeply important or perhaps countervalent. And I celebrate Worrison and other use of media to capture both the moments of solidarity and brutality. The Baltimore Uprising Archive is a wonderful resource of personal accounts by people who were there. But I also feel like there's unfinished business back up in the air. When we make media, and not least of all digital media, it's hard not to leave a part of ourselves in it. So the work this talk described is an attempt to bring these remnants and remainders out as traces of the surveillance apparatus, the institutions who wield it, and the hidden labor of its operation. even if the video itself is largely retrievable, there's still more to the media than what the video sensors pick up. This research and project are about how we might read what remains as a site of opacity of techniques and hidden labor. So I'm gonna address how the videos were made public quickly and then describe and show how I'm analyzing this. So on October 30th, about a week before the 2016 election, exactly 1 week before the 2016 election in what was a hectic news cycle, the Twitter account for the FBI Records Vault came back to life after a year of inactivity and began tweeting links to records on the vault. These include a background check on Trump's father, described as a real estate developer and philanthropist, records on General David Petraeus and Hillary Clinton. Among these records is this collection of Baltimore footage. In the frantic pre-election news cycle, this got some attention. Why was the FBI tweeting about Clinton records now of all times? Apparently the bot the FBI uses to automatically tweet about new files had been broken, received an automated update, and once fixed, began to tweet out its backlog. The FBI file vault is where the FBI posts some of the files and media made public as a result of FOIA requests, the Freedom of Information Act. The site hails us as users, citizens, and subjects. Among information activists, the FBI is infamous for non-compliance with public records requests. They often have to be sued to use the good search engine to find files. But the vault is where the charismatic ones get posted. Michael Jackson's, Marilyn Monroe, the Wu-Tang Clan's old dirty bastard, Abby Hoffman. There is clearly a curatorial effort being made here, and one that deserves some skepticism. FOIA requests into their selection criteria have been rejected. Almost all of these files are PDFs. Many of them are not searchable PDFs. Far fewer are photographs, and there is hardly any video. The Baltimore collection is posted into two separate collections. One is edited. One is not. The edited collection is hosted on YouTube. I have not yet been able to determine how or why the edits were made. The unedited collection is hosted. Unedited collection is hosted directly on the File Vault website. The difference is significant because YouTube doesn't make metadata available, and we'll be looking at that shortly. These files were requested by the ACLU. When hobby plane spotters who use inexpensive USB radios to track and crowdsource regional aircraft traffic noticed planes circling and reported the FAA tail codes on Reddit. I'm going to show a brief excerpt of one of the videos, but one in which the sensor is unable to capture what's happening on the ground. Guy Debord theorized that any radical form of art could be recuperated by the powerful, and now the FBI has recuperated glitch art. So this is a failed sensor that goes through a calibration process, but there's some more stuff happening here in the remains. We have some information in green, the day and time, a compass, other information. Does anybody know what B7E is? Rick, what's B7E?
It's the code for the exemption.
Yeah, it's the exemption for methods and practices. We also have these rectangles in the corners that are blinking. It can be a little hard to pick up. But they, it takes the center pixel of the video and uses that color to redact portions of the screen. So, in a sense, it's also an operative image. To stick with the vertical logic of surveillance, we might conclude that this video was released to show who's on top, like the blimps. But what's on top of what's on top? On top of the video is data. But it isn't really on top. It's burned in. Its pixels have replaced the pixels of what's underneath, burning in like time code or subtitles or watermarks on stock photos is a destructive superimposition of an image on another, destructive in the sense that the video has been rendered flat, two images become one, but also in the sense of turning data into an image. Burned in data is like veracity overload of a kind. A barrage of instrumental facts at 30 frames a second. Aerial photography is rooted in a kind of instrumental realism, and the inscriptive work here produces an inseparability that associates action on the ground with a full suite of measurements above, coordinates, camera settings, LIDAR. But an image of data is not data. And as Erica Midgeland pointed out at the last Poetics and Politics, in this space, that an image is not a fact. Jeffrey Bowker warns us that raw data is an oxymoron and a bad idea. But what about burned? This work of opacity is not quite a form of redaction, or is also in addition to redactions, but a form of reduction. It's legible to a viewer, but not queryable in the way that the sensor outputs of everyday life are now queryable. This isn't a cinema that invites pleasure of looking and not knowing. So I've started to build something that tries to unburn this data, to turn the images back into temporal metadata, and this is a prototype, a very early one. Now I can click it. This is using, OCR, optical character recognition, on every frame, using locations of sensor data to read the data back. This is dependent on knowing where the data is. The 18 hours of footage is split across several aircraft with several different makes of sensor. Each puts its data in its own place, which also makes it somewhat of a fingerprint. Part of determining which sensor is which is part of another of these operative images that I'm developing, which I'm gonna move on. This would take months to finish this file. So let's not wait around for that. So this is trying to remove all of the pixels that don't change, or rather the ones that do change and leaving the metadata. Planes are rarely stationary in the way that the burned in text is. These formal distinctions are expressed materially and can be detected. Operative images, once the domain of the suicidal cameras, Harun Faruqi described, that were used in the first Gulf War, are now fairly easy to construct in the browser. Load a video, copy the frame as an image, advance the playhead, copy the frame into another image, subtract one from another into a third image. If the difference is over a threshold, make it transparent, repeat. There's also a whole world of unburned metadata. I'm also trying to figure out what's in the redacted sections. And so that involves looking at promotional material from the sensor manufacturers. So what's usually obscured here is the location of the aircraft, the status of LIDAR, is it armed or not? LIDAR shows you the position of what's in the middle of the screen, and that's shown here as the target. So this is very militarized technology. Even though some of the marketing materials are very much around search and rescue cases. This is the metadata for one of the files that was hosted on the file vault. If the footage was hosted on YouTube, this would not be available. This file was produced in Premiere. Anybody in the room use Premiere? Just a few, okay. See anything interesting? So we get a time and date here. That's roughly a year after the protests. This is when the file was being prepared for release under FOIA. Adobe, in addition to making Premiere, has also specified the XMP metadata standard, XMP adding intelligence to media. XMP stores all of the files imported into a project. which we'll see in a moment. You get the exact version, Premiere Pro CC 2015 Windows, over and over and over again. Some of the other files were made on a different version of Premiere for the Mac. It's hard to see over my shoulder. These are the files that were imported into the project when it was being prepared. We have B7E again, and we have this. This is the raw video file that was produced by the sensor. It has the timestamp of when it was recorded, and it has the tail code for the airplane. Metadata leads to metadata. There's rich records that you can search. You can find the leasing company that doesn't exist. You get the full path. Desktop Meredith Project, Baltimore. This is probably the analyst's name and not the name of the project. RMD is Records Management Division. So you Premiere users are producing this in every project file and every MP4 that you export. So is this metadata more valuable than the content? To go back to a question that Rick asked. Maybe so. I think metadata has a different disposition. Keller Easterling uses this idea to think about dispositions of infrastructure, tendencies like a ball on an incline. Even if it isn't actively rolling, there's a disposition to roll. And so I think that ties into how we tend to read. How do we make and read metadata against the grain and resist reading this as a list of facts about the world, but contingent on particular moments of software that were written by people to do particular things. Certain fields exist in some versions and not others. So to wrap up, one of the contradictions here is how to acknowledge and attend to the injustice of the event while dealing with a part of the material that's necessarily formal. Yale Wiseman points out the tension between testimony, which is tied to memory, and trauma, and the forensic, which is based in expertise and its ability to convince. How do we work beyond story while preserving and honoring memory and trauma? Karen Kaplan writes that, I'm missing a word here. Distant and abstract, requiring expert interpretation to become even marginally intelligible, the aerial or satellite image most often requires the kind of infrastructure that can only be provided by nation states or major corporations. But this does not mean that reconnaissance photography cannot be marshaled for other politics. So what tools, poetic or technical, do citizens need in the face of these machines? For me, there's something important in making the process of sense-making itself a viewable subject, that reconstructing data from opaque surveillance isn't simply a process to produce a clean and sensible output, but that the process itself is subject to inquiry. I'm going to stop there. Thank you.